Nick Davis est Associate Professor, maître de conférence de Gender and Sexuality Studies in English à l'Université de Northwestern, donc de l'Université prestigieuse de Chicago. Et encore une fois, on le remercie beaucoup d'avoir fait le déplacement. Il travaille en termes de recherche sur le cinéma grand public et ses éléments narratifs, mais d'un angle, un angle de vue queer et féministe. Son livre, qui est paru chez Oxford University Press en 2013, parle de « The Desiring Image », c'est le titre, et il a établi une nouvelle théorisation du cinéma queer depuis la fin des années 80, notamment en y incorporant des éléments de la philosophie de Deleuze. Il publie beaucoup, notamment dans Camera Obscura, le Journal of American Drama and Theatre. Voilà, ses enseignements portent sur les Gender and Sexuality Studies, comme je l'ai dit. C'est donc sur l'introduction au cinéma queer, mais aussi il a un cours sur les réalisatrices femmes et notamment dans le niveau master, c'est-à-dire graduate school aux États-Unis, il a un cours qui s'intitule Introduction au sujet sexuel ou de sexe. Donc aujourd'hui, il va nous parler d'un réalisateur coréen qui s'appelle Andrew Ahn, comme c'est écrit sur la diapositive, Translating Identities and Traversing Media. Et je vais vous résumer. Alors vous avez sur les genoux, normalement, ou devant vous, le texte intégral de son intervention. Merci Nick de nous l'avoir donné. J'essaie de résumer le mieux possible quatre points que j'ai identifiés dans son intervention. Je ne fais pas d'analyse là, juste de résumé. Donc c'est à propos d'Andrew Ahn et le fait de regarder qu'est-ce que ça veut dire d'être un réalisateur gay asiatique dans un contexte culturel et de production américain. Donc il va aussi nous montrer, décrypter sa façon de voir les choses. Le second point qui est intéressant chez Andrew Ahn, c'est que c'est son côté transmédiatique, puisqu'il est à la fois réalisateur de films et réalisateur d'une série télé. Voilà. En troisième point, Nick va aborder, et c'est un hommage à la France, peut-être, je ne sais pas, la question de l'auteur au sens français du terme, nous dit-il, un peu dans la lignée maintenant très ancienne des cahiers du cinéma, c'est-à-dire comment voir, décrypter derrière le récit la main, la signature d'un artiste et d'un auteur. Et ça, je crois que c'est très très important quand on s'intéresse à l'approche queer des contenus audiovisuels. Voilà, j'en ai fini. Nick, the floor is yours. Take all your time, you've got 30 minutes.
Merci. J'ai parlé à une étudiante dans ma classe et elle m'a posé des questions qui concernent cette conférence et le sujet de mon papier. Et je les ai décrits. Et elle m'a dit, d'accord, mais pourquoi tu ne parles pas de Sense8? C'est le meilleur programme, n'est-ce pas? Je regrette. Merci à tout le monde pour être ici. Merci spécialement très fort à Grégoire pour l'invitation. Excusez-moi, s'il vous plaît, pour n'être pas capable de lire mon papier en mon pauvre français de lycée, mais j'ai essayé de préparer une présentation bilingue en PowerPoint. Excusez-moi encore pour les erreurs inévitables en mes traductions. Et pour le Q&A, probablement il faut le conduire en anglais, mais peut-être Grégoire peut traduire les questions en anglais.
Q&A, c'est questions-réponses.
Ah, hein? Merci.
Donc, qui auront lieu après l'intervention de Sarah tout à l'heure.
Eh bien. Filmmaker Andrew Ahn scored major successes in 2016 with Spa Night, his first feature. The movie tells the story of David, a closeted Korean-American teenager who helps support his financially struggling family by secretly obtaining a job in a 24-hour sauna for men, where he nervously pursues his first sexual encounters. The movie and its lead actor earned top prizes at several film festivals, including Sundance and Outfest, plus the John Cassavetes Prize from the Independent Spirit Awards, annually honoring the best movie released in the U.S. that cost less than $500,000 to produce. Despite all this acclaim, however, Ahn was not hired to direct anything else for 18 months after Spa Night premiered. When a job materialized, it was attached not to a film but to a TV show. the Sundance Institute, which had supported Ahn's shorts as well as his feature, and where he participated in prestigious training labs for screenwriting and directing, approached this rising star to direct all 6 episodes of the first series it had acquired for its new streaming service, Sundance Now. The show, titled This Close, was written and produced by the 2 deaf white actors who play the lead roles. Shoshana Stern is Kate, a Hollywood public relations worker preparing to marry a hearing man. And Joshua Feldman plays Michael, a gay graphic novelist battling depression after a breakup with his unfaithful boyfriend. Because one main character in This Close is a gay man, though neither is Asian, the press tends to frame Ahn's work on this show as either a logical continuation of his interest in unusual LGBT storytelling or as a surprising deviation from telling Asian American narratives. Whereas in interviews, Ahn himself stresses that his greatest challenge was learning to direct screenplays he had not written. I will focus today on how that test enables Ahn to build credentials as an auteur in the original sense developed here in France, as an artist whose formal style and artistic sensibility make a legible impression even in studio-supervised, genre-defined stories scripted by others. We will first review some audiovisual tactics by which Spa Night illustrates the hidden emotions of a character who will not speak or act, and how the film conveys his feelings of alienation even within his own cultural group. Beyond identifying Ahn's artistry, this quick survey of Spa Night's visual trademarks will indicate how the film and its maker must counter a unique set of stereotypes in creative ways. As a gay Korean American, Ahn belongs to a group that remains all but invisible on US screens, and I suspect on European screens as well. As many scholars, cultural historians, and documentary filmmakers have observed, much of US culture continues to present Asian American men as inexpressive, sexless, and lacking individual personality. These ignorant but durable projections constrain such men's appearances in straight or queer film and television, but Spa Night clears some helpful new paths out of that quandary. Some of these strategies resurface in the superficially dissimilar This Close, which has an unusually refined aesthetic for a US television series, and which faces some similar conundrums, that of evoking thoughts and feelings that cannot be spoken or heard in conventional dialogue, and that of communicating a sense of marginality or isolation, even within an already marginalized group. In reviewing how Ahn adapts his style for television, and specifically in relation to a different demographic of characters, I will also identify points where Spa Night and This Close intersect in their understanding of modern sexuality, especially, but not only, among gay men. Finally, I will ask the riskier question of whether we might consider This Close to be an Asian American representation, despite lacking any Asian protagonists. So, Spa Night's second shot, typical of how much of the movie unfolds, holds for 35 static seconds on the outline of somebody's towel-covered head inside a steam room, further blocked from view by a second person's neck and shoulder. Finally, David, our protagonist, removes that towel and utters his suggestive first line to this companion, "Papa, I can't breathe." For the rest of its 96 minutes, Spa Night investigates everything that statement could mean, implying David's gradual release from asphyxiating predicaments, visually tied to his emergence into close-up. But Spa Night proves more narratively and formally complicated than that, ultimately suggesting that getting David's face on screen, itself a rare feat for an Asian American man, much less a queer one, is only half the battle. Overlapping pressures related to sexuality, bankruptcy, faith, education, and filial and cultural decorum, so back to that sense of intersectionality that Anne was just talking about, paralyze David's voice, his facial expressions, and even his body, so rigidly comported in, except in scenes of his almost compulsive physical exercise. By the end, when David's boss catches him having sex with a man in the sauna where he works, with his drunken, jobless father snoring only a few rooms away, his pent-up performance erupts into great heaving sobs. This is not an unfamiliar trajectory for on-screen melodrama, and may even be predictable. Movies and television have trained audiences to await moments when the most emotionally aloof characters eventually crack. Something similar will transpire in the penultimate episode of This Close's first and so far only season, when Michael, who has been masking heartbreak with drink and secrecy and self-isolation, will also finally dissolve into tears. Two factors, however, make Spa Night's handling of this trope unusual. One concerns a risk of fueling stereotypes in a movie that strives to combat them. Céline Pereñas-Shimizu observes that the racist idea of the withdrawn, inexpressive Asian has as its reverse face another cliched projection of bottomless sorrow that must exist beneath that social veil. While filmmakers are not the only white filmmakers are not the only perpetrators of these ideas, too often, she insists, Asian American male directors and actors see the Asian American male body as a site of racial wounding, gender grief, and sexual problems in ways haunted by the framework of falling short of the norm. Indeed, Spa Night does portray David's disavowed desires for men and his sense of failing his parents' culture and class-informed notions of a perfect son as, in Freudian terms, a persistent melancholia that does finally explode into conscious mourning. But to avoid recycling this figure as exemplary of all Asian American men, An orchestrates his script and his shots to clarify that David's distress is far from uniform within his peer group. Spa Night, for example, presents Eddie, here on the left-hand margin, a childhood friend whom David visits at UCLA, as outgoing, romantically attached, and physically relaxed. He is also openly objectified by An's camera, refusing that other malingering conception of Asian men as asexual. In a sequence where Eddie's college friends take David to some parties, An fills the background with Asian extras, extending the depth of field to convey the varied looks, styles, and affects within this sizable crowd. If David's eventual breakdown feels rare for being specific to him, then, and not an implied allegory for all Asian American masculinity, it is also rare in refusing to train its lens directly on David's face, halfway denying spectators the melodramatic money shot of tearful outpouring. Our first sign of David's mounting despondency arrives not through his face at all, but via a one-quarter profile shot of his abdomen, which David, in his misery, has scrubbed until it bleeds. When we do cut to his face, we only see its right side. These techniques are prototypical of a film that often crops faces and bodies within literally eccentric frames that defamiliarize the Asian male body, inspiring viewers' visual curiosity in ways that resist its frequent desexing or outright invisibility in US screen entertainment. A second effect of these shots is to convey, often literally, David's own furtive gaze on bodies he cannot help ogling, despite his sense that he should not look. Even when he studies his own likeness in mirrors or selfies, these shots tend to diminish any sense of visual plenitude. They instead decenter and crop his reflection, another pattern that will emerge in this close as well as an early auteurist signature of An's. Moreover, even or especially when An's characters share a frame with ostensible peers, lenses and focal lengths repeatedly keep only one character in perfect focus at a time, intimating that the people in these shots are not fully inhabiting quite the same space or moment, the same degree of clarity and co-presence. Spa Night thus executes a complex double mission. On the one hand, furnishing representation to often overlooked cultural milieus, while also maintaining, through strategies like off-center framing or estrangingly tight close-ups, that psychic and social dynamics among these figures do not always produce community and may even resist visual transparency. Extending that paradox, we might describe any of the Korean-American or Korean-centered micro-societies in Spa Night as a culture of looking. That's true of the men's spa, with its poker-faced rituals of cruising and erotic telepathy, to the private households and church meals where everyone takes wordless stock of everyone else's performance of happiness and prosperity. Still, despite the weight placed on complex visual signals, vision is often limited or purposely thwarted, a rich but also a frustrated register of signification. The same proves true of language. Most characters toggle between English and Korean in different scenes or abruptly within the same discussion. An admitted to me when I interviewed him that he wrote Spa Night to be much more English-centric, but noticed that his actors resorted to Korean on the set or during improvisations when trying to express more personal ideas. He wanted then to free his characters to do the same thing, resulting in what he calls a bilingual cinema. Despite its taciturn protagonist, then, Spa Night amplifies the tricky, often furtive, but multi-layered verbal and visual communication that saturates encounters among its Korean-American characters. As the first U.S. television show starring, written by, and produced by deaf people, This Close faces its own challenges of correcting misperceptions. For example, the idea that deafness equals silence or a lack of language. An and his actors and colleagues, Shoshana Stern and Joshua Feldman, reprise the discourse of bilingualism to evoke the way the series balances scenes laden with spoken dialogue, other scenes entirely signed and subtitled, and still others that mix elements of both. As with Spa Night's range of Korean-American personality types and assimilation levels, no one figure or manner of being typifies all the deaf characters in This Close. Just to start, Kate has limited hearing and can express herself through speech, whereas Michael is more profoundly deaf and relies entirely on sign language. The phrase culture of looking, which I used earlier to capture the intense gazing and visual signaling in Spa Night, is one I'm stealing from Shoshana Stern's account of life among the deaf, for whom body language and meticulous reciprocal reading of each other are vital. In an interview, Stern provides this background to explain why Andrew Ahn was the whole team's dream director. She confides, "We're big fans of Spa Night and of his eye, and his ability to communicate things without even any dialogue." This unique series thus capitalizes on expressive audiovisual techniques that Ahn developed in relation to disparate cultural contexts. That said, This Close upends as many of Spa Night's aesthetic signatures as it preserves. For one, this series prohibits the director's usual predilection for tight close-ups, especially in shots where a character responds to off-screen dialogue. In such images, the signing hands of the characters would be invisible and the spoken dialogue inaccessible even to lip-reading members of the show's deaf audience, who are by no means its only spectators, yet their needs are of key concern to the production. Admittedly, a learning curve is visible from the show's first two episodes when the framing or blocking of some shots did preclude our access to the characters' signed conversations. But by the middle and later ones, they mostly avoid these errors. This is not to say Ahn relinquishes his off-center framings, obstructed views, or oblique angles on his characters, which still evoke, just like in Spa Night, in objective and subjective terms, the show's awareness of its characters, and even those characters' awareness of themselves as socially and emotionally adrift. Not because, though, they are deaf. Like many narratives focused on minority identities, This Close pays rigorous attention to the character's deafness, intersecting with Michael's gayness and with Kate's experiences of femininity and sexism, but also declines to reduce its characters to those identities. We never wanted the reason behind any action to be, "Oh, well, it's because these characters are deaf," Ahn reports. Feldman concurs in classical liberal humanist rhetoric. This story, he says, is not about the deaf experience, but experiences that Kate and Michael are having, and they happen to be deaf. The actor and co-writer insists this to a television news outlet, even though he attests to the more gay-targeted magazine The Advocate that he did partly co-develop the show and its preceding web series as a venue for processing and representing his very particular experience. "I grew up deaf, but didn't come out until much later," he says, "because it was so frightening to consider myself a double minority. It was overwhelming." The struggle to frame stories like This Close as simultaneously specific and universal is deeply familiar and economically necessitated, so I'm not presenting it to catch the creators amid a contradiction. Moreover, I do think that This Close succeeds in making the characters' disability and their gender and sexual identities relevant factors in all their experiences without indulging what Stern has called the worst, most recurrent version of storytelling about deaf people. "It's only when I'm presented," she says, "with a narrow and set view of what being deaf is, most often from the point of view of it being the loss of something and existing wholly within that loss, that I feel limited and frustrated." That notion of deafness as loss echoes the totalizing view of racial wounding or gender grief that Shimizu, denounces in so much Asian American representation. So once again, An has developed tactics for avoiding the same trap while still exploring the circumstantial melancholy of his characters. On the audio front, An refuses to employ a typical device by which other films and series have often muted their soundtracks to solicit a spectator's identification with hearing impairment. Stern protests that, quote, thinking about deafness as silence is entirely a construct of people who can hear. An, whose deft and textured sound design in Spa Night is an achievement I wish I'd had time to describe for you, thus furnishes the episodes of This Close with a flexible approach to audio. Several scenes are notable for their quiet without dialing all the way down to silence. Other scenes with creative sound design include Michael's multiple trips to a gay club, which omit a lot of the ambient sound in the club but do preserve the volume and the bass-heavy percussion of the house music, which Michael would hear as vibrations, if not as music per se. Still other scenes, including a comic encounter with Kate's ludicrous boss in episode 2, and a poignant climactic fight with her fiancé in episode 6, suppress and distort the dialogue with high levels of static and shrill electronic feedback. So that effect might not translate immediately to deaf viewers who cannot hear it, but they would certainly understand and recognize it as an all too common risk of having to rely on hearing technologies. That said, not every formal choice that This Close makes correlates to the character's deafness any more than every story turn does. Some tools of psychic portraiture persist from Spa Night, such as Andrew Ahn's fondness for mirrors, especially circular ones, often filmed from a diagonal angle, which only heightens the incompleteness of the character's reflections and their sense of seeing themselves on a literal periphery, almost never for disability-related reasons. An's trademark use of narrow visual depth, frequently consigning physically proximate characters to totally different degrees of clarity or blurriness, does a lot of dramatic work in This Close, a series whose title in English is equally idiomatic for extreme intimacy, as in a statement like, I love you, I love being this close to you, sort of tellement intime, maybe, and for failed connection, as in we came this close to making it work, so si près. Sometimes this technique heightens a character's awareness of their own exclusion, as when Kate's fiancé jealously observes his wife's inseparable bond and semi-private language with Michael, who are blurry in the extreme foreground. But variable focus is just as legible and even more poignant in scenes that would otherwise suggest a deep interpersonal connection, as when Michael and his ex-boyfriend Ryan have reunited and wind up in bed together. So here only Michael is in focus, and Ryan, right next to him, is already blurry, and that role gets reversed as they continue talking about how close they've become, but the camera doesn't totally agree. Even Kate and Michael, best friends of many years, often guilty of shutting out other people in deference to each other, cannot transcend this visual divide, which signals long before the final episode poses the danger of a potential rupture in their friendship. That these two remain mutually mysterious to each other confirms that This Close does not treat all deaf characters as magically synchronized or clear to each other. Instead, it indicates a smart approach to gender and sexuality, because often disparities linked to Michael's particular experiences of eroticism, alternate social formations, non-monogamous partner arrangements, and other aspects of what Andrew Ahn calls modern gay romance and the difficulties of figuring out marriage and family and intimacy are what prompt narrative conflict, or at least prompt the subtle audiovisual distance between Michael and Kate. For example, in episode 5's long flashback, Kate confides to Michael her instant adoration of his then-new boyfriend, Ryan, even as she admits, I'm just not sure about the open relationship. I would love him more if he just wanted you. So Michael urges her not to worry in one of the series' most candid, delicately acted conversations during which only he or only she is ever fully in focus within a frame. They are this close to seeing and hearing each other, but ultimately they do not. A main production company behind This Close is Killer Films, the crucial outfit behind a great deal of the new queer cinema of the 1990s, nourishing such seminal movies as Poison, Swoon, Go Fish, and Boys Don't Cry, and sustaining that momentum in the new century with Hedwig and the Angry Inch, Party Monster, Nasty Baby, and Carol, among others. So it's no surprise that this company would support a show like this close in its unbashful exploration of group sex, anonymous liaisons, recreational drugs, and camera-recorded sexual encounters, and other practices of modern desire that are certainly not exclusive to gay men, but may manifest frequently among us. Michael's and Kate's conversations rarely delve into these experiences. We as viewers witness them in scenes that pointedly exclude Kate, as when Michael abandons her during a joint trip to Seattle so he can, quote, be with my people. These are hardly the sole motives behind the eventual climactic conflict in episode 6, but they certainly factor in as a deeply wounded and lonesome Kate pleads to her retreating friend, but my life is your life too. And Michael responds, no, our lives could not be more different. You don't know. These lines of difference have rarely been verbalized in the series and never with such volatility, but on cinematography and mise-en-scène have trained us all along not to take the sameness of these characters for granted. I want to make one final point about modern forms of desire in this close before closing with a linked but provisional claim about race. Though the characters' sexualities occupy different positions along a homo to hetero spectrum, if such a model of desire even works, they all emanate a warm attachment, at least bordering on the erotic, to their screen devices. The characters often touch their devices and tablets earlier in the day and more frequently across it than they touch each other. Ryan and Michael literalize their ardent bond to their phones by filming themselves having sex, something that Ryan turns out to have been doing with other partners all along, even after he and Michael have vowed to close their relationship. This incendiary revelation transpires in an episode 5 scene where the wealthy Ryan is modeling his new tablet-controlled home entertainment system. That's what's happening in the bottom right here, which can adjust music as well as a series of colored lights in his living room, much to the delight of Michael and Kate, and even her ostensibly straight but sexually inhibited fiancé Danny, whom Kate and Michael admit semi-jokingly seems to want to fuck Ryan. Meanwhile, Michael accidentally pulls up a video of Ryan having very recent sex with his ex-partner Adam while trying to pull up a different photo he wants to show Kate on Ryan's other phone. And beyond the fact that this is all happening at once, notice that the lighting of that scene where they're just in the bottom right, where they're just pulling up a new system for the house, mirrors the color palette of all this kind of sex club scenes. Just like the scene of filming themselves having sex on their phone is finally using the color palette of scenes that are usually more domestic. This scene crystallizes then how 21st century devices exhibit both a sexual and a class-coded thrall of their own, kindling warm feelings but also violating those feelings when they allow indiscretions or when the machines act against our wishes. I must stress too, though, the specific value of these devices to deaf characters. Michael and Kate text each other frequently, as do Ryan and Michael, in iPhone-style dialogue bubbles that appear on screen, in a series, let's not forget, that is hosted on Sundance's streaming platform, which is only viable because of network devices. As a form of communication, texting levels out the different expressive capacities of hearing and non-hearing characters for whom platforms like FaceTime and Skype are heaven-sent substitutes for the analog telephone. Moreover, texts, which might be read or not, might be answered or ignored, might successfully or unsuccessfully convey their intended tone, open up a whole world of epistolary and communicative ambiguity that perfectly suits this series and its filmmaker, invested as they remain in the complexities and lapses and multisensory aspects of communication. They also allow, even without, so far, any narrative engagement with hookup apps like Grindr, to see screen-based networking and screen-based narcissism not merely as forms that facilitate modern sexuality, but as objects themselves of erotic investment. This idea surfaces in Spa Night as well, where the sexually isolated David gratifies his inchoate desires by using his phone, the single most expensive thing he owns, in a household beset by money troubles, so he can snap photos of his chest and penis and peer at them as if they were someone else's. If this close's interests in social, recreational, and assistive technologies were any more overt, I fear that reviewers might have linked that motif to Andrew Ahn's status as a Korean-American, based on a stale stereotype of Asianness, very broadly construed, as linked somehow indelibly to technology. This would be absurd and tasteless, especially given the universal fervor for such devices among everyone, as depicted in the show and as manifest all around us. I would love not to believe this would have happened, but the sometimes frank and sometimes euphemistic language in which reporters voiced their surprise about Andrew Ahn directing a show about non-Asian characters suggests to me that narrow stereotype still remains very much the order of the day. To help me think about Ahn's predicament in closing as a Korean-American artist, one who prompts confusion when he tells non-Asian stories, but then has to insist when he does make a film about gay Korean-Americans that he is not merely trafficking in autobiography, I consulted Christopher Fan's article, Melancholy Transcendence, Ted Chiang, An Asian-American Post-Racial Form. That essay responds to Yoon Mi Chang's definition of post-racial Asian American fiction as literature written by Asian American writers that does not contain Asian American characters or address Asian American experiences. In a sense, this close represents a televisual equivalent to that literary concept, which Fan explores in relation to Ted Chiang's award-winning short stories in science fiction, a genre that has been fairly inhospitable to Asian American writers, despite that stubborn stereotype, in and probably beyond U.S. culture, that Asians naturally gravitate towards scientific subjects. At least according to Fan, Chiang's solution to that double bind was to purge his work of any racial markers. If such an effort were really possible, and Fan has his doubts, readers could form any vision they like of this race-neutral characters, whose preoccupations with science can consequently avoid conjuring some myth about Asian technophilia that Chiang wants neither to feed nor to deny. Andrew Ahn faces a similar dilemma, faces a different dilemma. Firstly, because his audiovisual medium innately prevents the possibility of any character being racially unmarked, which is different from being racially ambiguous. Secondly, he has taken an arguably opposite approach, presenting two deaf leads in the first series ever centered around deaf characters, further marked by the specificity and power dynamics particular to their genders and sexualities, and marked again by their whiteness, which loses its normative invisibility as a race because Ahn does not share it. In their intersectional particularity and their evident rarity within the televisual marketplace, Michael and Kate are the very opposite of unmarked. And thirdly, this close does not really fit Chiang's model anyway of post-racial fiction, because despite journalists' typical focus on protagonists only, the show does include Asian American characters. Three, in particular, play major roles, all of them women, and none of them especially sympathetic. Sarah, a junior event planner working under Kate, who brazenly attempts to steal her job, played by Chinese American actress Cynthia Wu. Dorinda, the book editor who rejects Michael's second manuscript and accuses him of breaching his contract, played by Hawaiian-born Japanese-American actress Keiko Agena. And Mona, the moderator of a disability panel that winds up exacerbating Kate's sense of being tokenized and marginalized as the deaf girl in her office. And this character is played by Korean-Japanese-Chinese-American actress Nicole Bilderback. One could venture a doubly laudatory and in its own way a post-racial reading of what, after three data points, we must consider a casting trend within this close. That Ahn maybe has made sure not to render Asian Americans invisible, especially Asian American women, even though they are absent from the center of his series. And that he's reached a point where he does not feel pressure to cast them only in idealized audience-friendly roles. But one can imagine a darker reading as well. That despite the empathy Spa Night radiates toward its mostly male Korean-American characters, that empathy has somehow evaporated in this subsequent project in ways that Ahn may or may not have the power on set to control. The brunt of this change has landed heavily on a trio of Asian women. All of us know that progressive advances within one text or career do not prevent simultaneous retreats, and that we poorly manage our work as LGBTQ scholars if we ignore the demands of feminist and anti-racist reading practices as well. And so I end this paper, partly out of duty to our timetable today, with an open and somewhat worrying question, which perhaps we may take up together. Merci.